Good evening, Bob. Welcome to the space show.
Thank you.
You're area control officer of the Woomera Rocket Range. Does that mean that you have in charge of you the looking after the farmers and so on? Because we've seen sheep and so on the range, and I presume they're looked after by some farmers. How do they know when the rocket firing's going off?
Well, that's right. We have to look after the everybody that has properties within the boundaries of the Woomera Rocket Range. We have to keep track of where they are, who they are, so that if there is a firing at any stage, we have to notify them, let them know that there are certain areas that they will not be allowed to go. And in some instances, back in the early days, we even had to build a bunker type, a bomb shelter, I guess you would call it, at all the stations for some of the bigger launchings that went out a long way. The station people, homestead owners, were notified that there was going to be a big launch, and they were expected to go and hide in these shelters. But we found out after a fair period of time that these shelters were excellent to use as storage for food. They were just like cellars, and they also provided a very good vantage point from which to watch the launches, especially the Dazzle project, where they were done at night time, and a very spectacular fire in the sky. And the station people used to just stand on top of the bunkers, and they thought it was a great viewing area.
You mean to say that, and they were supposed to go down to the bunker, and they got on top and had a look?
That's right, yes. So I don't know what would have happened if there was ever an accident, but they thought that was magic. They had these government-sponsored viewing platforms so they could watch what was happening.
I must say, I think I might have done the same.
Yes, because some of the night firings are very, very spectacular. The Redstone project, which was Project Dazzle, they actually did a lot of night firings, and they were very spectacular because of the fact that they were doing re-entry trials, I believe. I didn't really have much to do with the trials because I wasn't here at the time, but I've since found out that these particular trials involved firing another boost rocket on re-entry, so that they came back in very, very fast, and of course there was a very spectacular glow from these.
A bit like a shooting star, meteorite.
Yes, a bit like a shooting star, but I guess a little bit brighter, a bit closer to the surface. I think that this particular project led into the Americans doing a lot of their re-entry stuff. The project here sort of helped them out with a lot of the stuff that they required for their manned space program.
Okay. Coming more into the present day, have there been any rocket firings since those heydays, you know, when we had Aldo and the reset firing and all that sort of thing?
In 1987, with the discovery of the supernova 1987A, of course everybody wanted to get in on the act and have a look and see what it was and what caused it and what we can do or what we could learn from it. And so the Germans came out here in, I think it was towards the end of 1987. They launched a Skylark rocket with a lot of sensing instrumentation on board. This particular rocket was launched at night, as was a lot of the other sounding rockets. I think at the time the winds were a bit stronger than they expected, and this rocket landed fairly close into the range head. So they were at the time they were in no hurry to go out and recover the rocket in the morning. So by the time they got there, they found the site where it was supposed to have fallen, but it wasn't there. I understand the early morning winds had come up, actually opened up the parachute and dragged it some 8 kilometres. So by the time they actually recovered it, a lot of the payload had been fairly severely damaged.
Consequently, so what did they do? They just followed the scud marks and
Yes, just follow the drag marks, and they found it. Normally, the position of impact is given fairly accurately because of the radar fix that they give when they. Well, they track it with radar, and the fix is normally fairly accurate. So when they found the point of impact, they were very discerned the fact that it was gone. They thought someone had come and stolen it.
The Germans weren't the only ones that launched Skylark or Black Barnet rockets at that time, were they?
No, that's right. NASA got involved in it. A lot of the American universities were also interested in this information. So they got together a project and they used Black Barnet rockets with Terrier as boost rockets. They were two-stage rockets. They were fired from EC2, the same place as the German rocket, but they were, I'm not sure whether they went to a higher altitude, but they certainly were landing a lot further down range. They were launched at night time again, as I said, and normally about 1 o'clock in the morning. So a lot of the townspeople wanted to go out and see them, but there was a lot of bleary eyes during that period because people tended to stay out until it was all over. But I actually got involved in the rocket recoveries at that time. Now these rockets, the first stage burnt for about 4 seconds, took the vehicle up to an altitude of about a kilometre or so in that first initial 4 second burn. The first stage then dropped off and the second stage took it up to a height of some 300 kilometres. At Apogee, I believe that's when all the research was done, the all the bits and pieces opened up, and reflectors, mirrors, and gamma ray, X-ray machines, whatever it was, I don't know, that did all their stuff. And then they fell back down and were landing around about 200 kilometres downrange from where they were launched. This all took place in around about 12 minutes from time of launch.
So that means then it was in outer space, but perhaps not in orbit.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite incredible when you think that a vehicle has travelled that distance in that short a time. It's just mind-boggling. A lot of people can't comprehend the speed that these rockets travel. I think the Black Barnet was capable of, or I think it reached a maximum speed of something like 7,000 kilometres per hour. So it's really fascinating. But once these rockets were back on the ground, or the payload, I should say, was back on the ground, the recovery team was given a set of coordinates that were given to them from the radar fix. It was just a matter of a bearing and a distance from launch point. And they were sent out in four-wheel drive vehicles to recover the payload. It normally involved around about a 4 to 5 hour drive to find them. And this was, of course, done at night time. The aim of the game was to be there before the sun came up so that we could secure the payload, remove the parachute before the morning winds came up. During this time, we had six launches from the American group, and out of those six, I think four of the units were located just alone, just with the radar fixes alone. They did have satellite navigation instruments on board, and the aircraft that were put in the air at daylight were supposed to hone in on that and then guide the ground crew in the final distance across country.
Well, Bob, once you found the satellite, or rather the payload, it's not a satellite, obviously, what did you do then?
Well, certain parts of the payload were able to be brought back by road, but there were certain areas of it that were fairly susceptible to shock. The first couple we did bring back by road, and we found that it was a bit too rough. The roads out there, some of them haven't been used for some 30 years, and they weren't in very good condition. So what we ended up doing was unbolting the main part of the payload that was very vulnerable, and was actually loaded into a helicopter. Now, one would think the easiest way would be to sling it underneath a helicopter on a rope, but no, that what they wanted to do was to actually put it inside the helicopter in a cradle. Can you imagine a payload? These payloads were probably about, on average, 6 or 8 feet long and approximately 18 to 20 inch diameter. So there's this helicopter flying along with a payload sticking out the doors crossways. So it did look a little bit funny.
Yes, the photographs you've shown sort of look, you know, sticking out both sides of the helicopter, a bit like a power pole rammed through the helicopter.
Yeah, that's right.
How did it affect the flying performance of the chopper?
Well, funny enough, we thought it would be a fairly simple sort of thing to poke it through the doors. You have about the same amount sticking out each side and away they'd go. But the pilots were very concerned. What they did was, after we secured the load, they would take off and just hover just a few feet above the ground just to make sure that they had the load balanced correctly before they would attempt to return to the test shop. They flew the payload direct back to the test shop at the Woomera Instrumented Range, and we returned by road with the other bits and pieces. Normally the round trip took about 16 hours, so it was a fairly hectic sort of a day.
I should say so. Did they ever use the payloads again? You know, there were six firings. Did they just have completely six separate sets of instruments and obviously six rockets, or did they reuse some of the instruments?
I think they probably did reuse a lot of it, but a lot of the experiments were done by individual university groups. So one group would do experiment for one type of thing, and the next one would do it for something else. Each of the rockets were slightly different in their configuration, the size, or in length or diameter. So I presume that there was a lot of it that was probably reused, but a lot of it was just individual payloads.
Have you had any feedback from the scientists? Did they get the results they were looking for? Sort of any congratulatory message saying, thanks guys, we got our data?
Yes, we had a fair bit of feedback. We kept in touch. There was certain members of the crews that came every time because they were required for the actual launching of it, and then there were the crews that handled the payload. So the payload crews, we might see them once only, but the actual launch crew, we used to see them all the time, and they would give us feedback on whether they thought the information they got was worthy, I think they were quite pleased with what they've got. As you know, the Supernova 1987A was only visible from the Southern Hemisphere, and Australia provided the excellent facilities for launching to have a look at this. I understand the only other place that they could have launched from would have meant that their payload, they couldn't recover over land. It would have landed in the ocean, which probably wouldn't have done their instrumentation much good.
That's very interesting, Bob. Thanks for joining us tonight on the Space Show.
It was my pleasure. I'm glad to have been able to be of some assistance to you.